This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
There are times when you listen to The Health Show and every feature flows into the next with a clear theme and obvious plan. Well, not today. On today's Health Show, it's four different features on four different topics, none of which have anything to do with the other.
Definitely, we've all talked about, you know, you have more men calling about caring for their loved ones.
First, we'll hear about the growing trend of males becoming family caregivers.
Then, advice from the NIH. Get up and do something. Anything.
We'll hear how many people in our gadget-obsessed culture need a digital detox.
And commentary from our friend Judah LeBlanc about what he'd give for a good night's sleep.
I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. The number of men who are taking on the role of family caregiver is growing. In fact, up to 45% of caregivers are now males. The Alzheimer's Association says that in the last 15 years, the percentage of men caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's or dementia has more than doubled, from 19% in 1996 to 40% in 2009. Here to talk about this trend is Leanne Reynolds, president of Home Watch Caregivers International. We spoke recently, and I asked when she first started to notice this trend.
Well, actually, that's very interesting. I ran my own franchise in Portland, Oregon for a number of years before I came out here to kind of assume the role of the presidency. You know, so certainly we saw many times, you know, where men would be calling up, whether they're sons or husbands or grandsons, and, you know, they were taking on the responsibility to arrange care. So I would say kind of informally, I noticed it in my own location. Over the last couple of years, you know, we have just definitely seen more of a trend. When we ran an award here for National Family Caregiver of the Year, there were many more men that were nominated. And I think, you know, just informally through our own research, talking with our franchise partners and working with them in the field, definitely we've all talked about, you know, you have more men calling about caring for their loved ones.
And let's just talk about what we mean by caregiver. And what, well, when do you say, okay, this one, you cross this line and you become a caregiver?
You know, I think it's really when you begin to help them primarily with the kind of activities of daily living, you know, things that help them sort of maintain and sustain quality of life. So you're starting to help, your loved one potentially, you know, get dressed or go to the bathroom. Perhaps you're even starting with something smaller, like helping them with meal preparation or transportation to and from doctor's appointments. Or you get involved in heavy care where you're, you know, actually helping lift them, or you're doing medication management for them, things to really help them stay safely and securely in their home.
You have started this program where people can call or contact professionals to get help. What type of help do you find caregivers usually look for? And is there a difference when a male calls or a female calls?
Well, yes. We started an online portal, okay, that was specifically targeted for male family caregivers. And the reason we started that is because many times, we felt, A, that it's kind of unrecognized that you actually have this trend of more men being caregivers. I think the Pew Research Center came back and said, you know, in their recent study that up to 45% of caregivers are men today. But we really started this portal or this online forum because many times men and women share the same concerns about their loved ones. You know, they are all concerned potentially about the safety of their loved one or their health and wellness, that, you know, things are happening and getting done in an appropriate manner. But the way men and women approach solving those situations can be different. Sometimes you will have women who are much more involved with kind of social circles and networks and talking with friends and family about seeking advice and assistance and help. And we have seen where men don't necessarily gravitate in that direction. So that's why we kind of created this online portal, so men could come there and kind of have that support group online. They could have and, you know, answer questions and have this informal support group, but in an online forum. You did ask me kind of, you know, how do they differ? many times women might feel a little bit more comfortable doing some of the more personal care, you know, potentially bathing their parents or helping them get dressed. Sometimes we see the men gravitate to more helping with the financial or household duties, but once it kind of crosses over into that personal or intimate care, they want to hire a caregiver to come in and do those kind of things. So that's just sort of one example, how they kind of approach things a little bit differently.
Gender roles are changing so rapidly in the U.S. right now, in fact, around the world right now. Are these changing roles and attitudes maybe contributing to the fact that men see their role as being a caregiver now, whereas before that just, you know, that wasn't men's work?
Oh, yes. I think the changing and social demographic factors, you know, I think the fact that many of us do live remote from our parents, that, you know, more women are in the workplace, that men are more actively participating in the caregiving role. You know, you have men walking around with the baby Bjorns, and I think that's part of how we are changing from a social perspective, you know, that they are participating in kind of some maybe different roles.
Is this a growing, the male caregiver community, is this a growing enterprise? Do you see it becoming more and more popular?
Yes. So, you know, it's an online portal today. So currently today, like, we have like over 300 posts, and we have a lot of people on there talking about a wide range of topics, you know, so they might be talking sort of like, you know, where do I go to maybe seek some legal assistance, or where am I going to find out if there might be benefits available to provide care for my loved ones. But then you also have the very intimate questions on, like, you know, how do I talk to my boss about the fact that I need to take more time off to spend time with an aging parent? I am assuming the primary role. How do I talk or approach my workplace about that? So we see the forum as evolving, but certainly we also want to put on, you know, important articles to point people to information. We want to provide resources. You know, we want it to continue to grow and evolve and kind of be this support group, not just for men. Women can come too, but kind of approaching situations that they might have differently.
And how can people access this this online portal?
Okay, well, the portal is malecaregivercommunity.com.
And beyond that, are there places to go for additional help, say if there's someone needs service in their local community where they can be pointed to where that might, you know, again, these are unfamiliar roles, so they might not know where to go?
Yeah, I think with both these websites, it'll point you to a wide range of resources. So certainly on malecaregivercommunity.com, you know, there are resources that will link you to a local, you know, Department of Aging, or will link you to where you can go to potentially look or investigate veterans benefits, where you can go to get specific information if your loved one is faced with a particular chronic condition or they've had a stroke. So we do have a wide range of resources and links off of both these websites that can point you to different directions, not only for aid, but also where to look for different care options, also different care providers.
Leanne Reynolds is the president of Home Watch Caregivers International.
I'm a 20th century man, but I don't want to be young.
The National Institutes of Health has some advice. Do something. Anything. NIH research shows that leisure time physical activity is linked to longer life expectancy, even at low levels of activity and regardless of one's body weight. Wally Akinso reports.
Leisure time physical activity can possibly extend life expectancy.
We found that even a very low level of activity, equivalent to about 10 minutes of walking per day, was associated with a gain of almost 2 years of life expectancy. And that was regardless of body weight level.
Dr. Stephen Moore is the author of this NIH study.
At the very high levels of physical activity, and by very high, I mean equivalent to about 45 or more minutes per day of walking, we found a gain of about 4 years of life expectancy.
Researchers examined data on more than 650,000 adults. These participants, mostly age 40 and older, took part in one of six population-based studies that were designed to evaluate various aspects of cancer risk.
Physical activity was associated with lower risk of cancer mortality in our study, which is part of why it extended life expectancy, but it was also associated with lower risk of other causes of mortality as well.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommends that adults ages 18 to 64 engage in regular aerobic physical activity for 2.5 hours at moderate intensity or 1.25 hours at vigorous intensity each week.
So we looked at moderate to vigorous intensity activities in our study. And that includes any activity that's as intense as a brisk walk or more intense. Technically speaking, it's any activities that burn 3 or more times as many calories as sitting.
After accounting for other factors that could possibly affect life expectancy, researchers found that life expectancy was 3.4 years longer for people who reported that they did the recommended level of physical activity.
So the participants that did the recommended level of physical activity had a gain of about 3.4 years in life expectancy compared to those who did no leisure time physical activity. And by no leisure time physical activity, that means that they may have done their normal, what we call baseline activities. They may have done some walking to and from their car to get to work, but they didn't do any deliberate exercise or physical activity.
Dr. Moore says he saw benefit at low levels of activity.
So the very low levels of physical activity here, and what I mean by that are people who did the equivalent of about 10 minutes of walking per day in leisure time physical activity. So doing just that amount of leisure time physical activity, it's not very much, was associated with about a 20% decreased risk of death during the follow-up of our study. And in terms of life expectancy, that was about almost 2 years of life gained.
Researchers found that the association between physical activity and life expectancy was similar between men and women.
So it seems like the benefits of physical activity are relatively universal across different subgroups. So the findings were similar. There seemed to be a little bit more of a stronger effect in blacks than in whites, but otherwise very similar across the different groups.
Dr. Moore examined how life expectancy changed with the combination of both activity and obesity.
So being both inactive and obese was very hazardous for health. There was a loss of about 7.2 years of life expectancy in those who were both inactive and obese compared to someone who was active and normal weight.
Physical activity has been shown to help maintain a healthy body weight, maintain healthy bones, muscle, and joints, and reduce the risk of certain diseases, including some cancers. For more information on this study, visit cancer.gov. This is Wally Akinso, NIH, turning discovery into health.
Still to come, have you checked emails, tweets, and phone messages several times in the last 10 minutes? Then you may need a digital detox. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1296.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. The medical community is starting to take internet addiction more seriously. The American Psychiatric Association plans to include internet use disorder, that's the official medical term, in the appendix of their Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. And so, if technology is the new addiction, then digital detox is the new rehab. And yes, there are hotels that offer digital detox rooms and even tech-free public spaces. But for those that need a little more help unplugging, there are digital detox retreats. That's where Brenda and Cord Campbell ended up. They found a retreat in Northern California. John Myers reports.
Brenda and Cord Campbell started out like a lot of couples. High school sweethearts from Oklahoma, they got married, had a couple of kids, and moved to California to be closer to the tech industry. Their use of electronic gadgets started out innocently enough, an iPad in the bedroom, a laptop at the dinner table, but slowly they became the poster family for digital overload. They were profiled in the New York Times and on ABC News. Brenda knew they were in trouble.
You know, I realized that a lot of nights I would be standing in the kitchen cooking dinner by myself. Our son was off playing a game. Our daughter was watching, a show on the iPad, and then Cord was in working.
In his home office, Cord Campbell was surrounded by a semicircle of computer monitors.
Oh, God, yeah. There was a ton of friction in the marriage.
The need to stay connected to the internet got pretty bad. Brenda remembers that before going on a camping trip to a remote area, Cord rigged up a device that essentially turned their family car into a Wi-Fi hotspot.
It's just a slippery slope that we all fell into. We kind of took a look and said, yeah, this isn't working.
It's not working for a lot of people, and the travel industry is catching on. A new report says digital detox tourism is an emerging trend.
When you check into the hotel, we ask you to turn over all digital devices, your laptops, your iPhones, your iPads.
Christina Bush created a digital detox package at the Renaissance Pittsburgh Hotel. After someone makes a reservation, Bush always follows up with a phone call just to make sure her guests understand what the digital detox includes, or more importantly, what it doesn't include.
Now, I want you to fully understand, when you come to the hotel, there will not be a TV in your room. The iPod dock station will also be gone from your room. The alarm clock will be gone from your room. The only thing that we do leave in the room is the telephone. And we have had people at that point cancel the reservation. I think they're intimidated.
But are people intimidated or rewired?
Technology has the ability to change our brains.
Kelly McGonigal is a health psychologist who lectures at Stanford. She says we're starting to understand more about why devices are so addictive.
Devices are so addictive because they're activating the reward system of the brain. When we come to associate anything with the promise of reward, the brain begins to pump out a neurotransmitter called dopamine in response to seeing that object.
For a lot of people, that object is their smartphone. And the dopamine that the brain produces can make our phones irresistible. In the U.S., 80% of smartphone users report that they almost never leave home without their device. And, McGonigal says, there's some alarming research suggesting that our attachment to devices can make us more focused on immediate gratification and lead us to make bad choices.
The more time we spend with our devices, the more likely that we may be shifting towards our more impulsive self and perhaps our more self-destructive self.
The medical community is starting to take internet addiction more seriously. The American Psychiatric Association plans to include internet use disorder, that's the official medical term, in the appendix of their Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. And so, if technology is the new addiction, then digital detox is the new rehab. And yes, there are hotels that offer digital detox rooms and even tech-free public spaces, but for those that need a little more help unplugging, there are digital detox retreats. That's where Brenda Campbell and her husband ended up. They found a retreat in Northern California.
And then they said, okay, it's time to give us all your electronics. And so he saw my camera and he said, yeah, the camera too. And I thought, well, how am I going to have memories of this? And so, yeah, we turned all that in and there was a moment of, oh, wow, you feel a little naked without the stuff.
The Campbell's retreat was co-created by Levi Felix.
We give everyone a journal and say, if you feel like taking a photo, if you feel like you have the urge to document something, draw it or write about it.
Each month, Levi and his partner, Brooke Dean, lead groups of 10 to 14 people through 4 days of tech-free living.
We get people up quite early.
And then they're served fresh juice.
And then we do about a two-hour yoga and meditation class.
Or we go on a long hike in the redwoods.
They don't know what time it is. We take their watches away. But there's usually quite a bit of free time, lots of optional activities.
Art activities and writing workshops.
And then more free time to go soak in the hot springs or relax under a tree.
So, do we have hard data showing that digital detox works? Not exactly. It's too early to tell. And even though tech addiction is starting to be taken more seriously, Levi Felix agrees, there's no consensus on exactly how to treat it.
The big question of the digital detox is just to think about, what does it mean to be human? And what does it mean to have these amazing devices and technologies? And I don't have all the answers. You know, I'm figuring it out just like everyone else is.
There may not be an official 12-step program for how to kick digital addiction, but Levi and Brooke seem to be onto something. For Cord Campbell, the digital detox retreat has been transformative.
I would have to say that it is a bit life-changing. Technology oftentimes gets in the way of having a good, honest conversation with people sometimes, which can only be had when you're sitting across the table from them talking to them.
After the retreat, Cord and Brenda made some changes. Like every day at 6 p.m., they drop what they're doing and have dinner as a family. No devices allowed. And they don't allow devices in the bedroom either.
And Brenda and I have talked to each other more over the last year than we have probably in the last 5 years.
And it's the small things. It's definitely the small things, but they are cumulative and they've helped us a lot.
Digital detox may not be for everyone, but as modern life becomes more and more dependent on the digital world, it just might be the thing that helps some of us find balance. I'm John Myers.
Our friend Judah LeBlanc has been carrying on a long-term love affair in his bedroom. Don't worry, this is rated G.
Back in my 20s, I carried on a virtual love affair with my bed. I looked forward to my nightly slumber of 8 hours free from the obsessive thoughts that cycled through my brain. My life energy went into keeping my head above water, holding down a job, maintaining a few friendships, working out. I was a glass-half-empty man who couldn't shake the belief that I was destined to remain alone, a gay version of Steve Martin's single guy consigned to dusting his plants. Still, there was always something, at least one thing, to look forward to, my appointment with my mattress, when I could fall into deep, dreamless sleep. Fast forward 25 years. Today, in my 50s, after months, years, decades of self-improvement, of everything from acupuncture to yoga to a loosely formed cult, I've calmed down some and no longer carry the depression that dogged me for the first 40 years of my life. At 55, I look back on the last 10 years, the sweetest yet, a gradual lifting of the veil of sadness, replaced by something like hope. And yet, while I acknowledge the opening of my life in middle age, becoming a writer and teacher, dating men, taking up space, I've come up against a new obstacle to my happiness. I can't sleep. Okay, I'm exaggerating. I can't sleep through the night, can't get 8 or even 7 hours, and settle for 5 or 6. In my early 40s, I developed dry eye syndrome. Suddenly, my eyes burned, ached, and didn't produce enough tears. While my life was getting better, my eyes were getting worse. And that condition, along with another souvenir of middle age, an enlarged prostate, led to sleep deprivation and my hunger for a good night's rest. Just as I overcame my depression, I was determined to soothe my dry eyes and resolve my sleep issues. And so over the next 5 years, the next 10, I went to doctors, dry eye specialists, tried acupuncture and massage. I drank herbal teas, went on special diets, used drops and gels, all for naught. On my dry eye odyssey, I learned that doctors are not all-knowing. Sometimes their bag of tricks is simply empty. Over the last month, I've taped my eyelids closed at night, the specialist's last resort advice. In desperation, I returned to the Chinese herbalist I visited occasionally over the years. In Chinese medicine, I'm carrying too much heat and need to cool my body down. Drink warm things, he said. We'll make you special tea. The tea smells bad and tastes worse, but I'm drinking it twice a day, morning and night. I don't know, don't want to know exactly what's in it, but somehow it seems to be working. I'm sleeping more and waking up less. Sometimes, after a restless night, I wish I could go back in time and zone out like my 25-year-old self. But then I look around and savor my 50-something life and the hard-fought wisdom that goes with it, a life I wouldn't give up even for a good night's sleep.
Judah LeBlanc is a writer, storyteller, and teacher in Boston. He's the author of the memoir, Finding My Place, and is currently performing his one-man show, Finding My Place, One Man's Journey Through the Middle Ages. You can hear, see, and read more of Judah's work at judahleblanc.com. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.